Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What drives our endless obsession with sharks? Long before Peter Benchley's novel and Steven Spielberg's movie put us all on the lookout for Jaws, these ever-circling razor-toothed fish have inspired both reverence and terror in seafaring people all over the planet. Not surprisingly, such fascination also breeds a fair amount of myth about sharks, including our wildly oversized worries about the danger they pose to humans who thought it was safe to get back in the water. Washington Post environmental reporter Juliet Alperin shares the story of sharks and our relationship to them in her book, Demon Fish, Travels Through the Hidden World of Sharks. We're delighted she could be with us this afternoon. Juliet, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much.
So I want to get this out of the way. You don't think sharks are demon fish, but lots of people have said horrible things about them down through the years.
Absolutely. They've really had a bad, you know, bad PR from the beginning. And when you look, whether you're talking about the way the Phoenicians depicted them in their pottery or kind of how they got their name, which really came from a Mayan basically demon who devoured women and children. They've had a tough rap over the years.
And we'll get to the great shark information in short order, but it is interesting that the book reads in many ways as a sort of report card on the overall health of the oceans.
Right. I actually chose to write about sharks not because I'm obsessed with them, though I think they're quite interesting, but I actually thought they were a fascinating way to look at the oceans and our relationship with the sea as one of the top predators and a fish that's globally distributed. It's an amazing way that you can look at how people across the world are interacting with the sea and how the ocean is changing.
We've done a couple different shows here over the years on wolves, and it struck me that there was a parallel there.
There absolutely is. I mean, in many ways, frankly, scientists right now are looking at sharks performing really the same function that, say, wolves would in Yellowstone or out in the West. And they do the same thing in coral reef systems and, in fact, both keep mid-level predators in check. And one of the things I like is that they not only eat them, but sometimes they just freak them out and they can manage to, for example, keep a seagrass habitat from being over-consumed because the other fish just don't want to be there when they're around.
So sharks come in literally all shapes and sizes. What makes a shark a shark?
The main thing that makes them a shark is the fact that they're a cartilaginous fish. So rather than being the bony fish you might think of when you're going out fishing, they actually have cartilage throughout their body, and that performs the structure. They also don't have the kind of swim bladder that we think of when we generally think of fish, and that's actually one of the ways that, in fact, you can do catch and release with sharks, and generally they end up in pretty decent condition.
Mm-hmm. And the reason that they don't have that swim bladder, have they not evolved the same way as other fish?
They evolved differently. They diverged, and as a result, they actually basically obtain their buoyancy through their liver and kind of the oil and that they have in their liver, and so that they don't need a swim bladder the way that other fish do.
And their liver is one of the reasons that they are hunted today.
Yes, and interestingly, that's where you get into things like beauty products, which is kind of unusual, but there's essentially an element, squalene, that's in sharks that is something that's used for basically kind of performing that function that collagen does, that basically it's a wonderful moisturizer. And so as a result, you've seen the targeting of sharks throughout the world, particularly deep water sharks, to be put in beauty creams and soaps. And so that's something that's definitely inspired a bunch of debate recently.
So the trade in sharks for their fins is really astonishing. Just if you're just looking at the fin trade alone, that's $73 million a year?
It can be up to $73 million a year. One thing is scientists are trying to figure out the precise number, but there's no question that tens of millions of sharks each year are taken for their fins.
And then they're literally taken only for the fins very often.
Yeah. While, you know, there is a market in meat and there certainly are some people who do eat the meat and it actually ends up in fish and chips or sometimes on a restaurant that you can see in Dallas or elsewhere, really the fins are what are so valuable because they're used for an Asian delicacy called shark's fin soup. And since that's where you get the real money, that's what's driving the intentional targeting of sharks.
When did shark fin soup become such a big deal?
Well, it's an interesting question because it really was a big deal in the Ming Dynasty, and that's really kind of where it got its start hundreds of years ago. But it actually had fallen out of favor, for example, when communists were in control of China and it was seen as an elite food that wasn't desirable. So it was the 80s and the 90s where it started coming back. And it really has just been in the last decade or so that this trade has really exploded, particularly as more people, whether it's in China or countries with Chinese populations, can afford to buy the soup. And that's where you've seen kind of the global explosion of the shark fin trade.
And the practice of finning, very often when we talk about them not using the rest of the fish, they will take the fish and take the fins off and then throw this poor animal still alive and bleeding back into the ocean.
They do that sometimes. I think it's very hard to figure out exactly what numbers we're talking about in that instance. But and one of the facts is often, say, the shark is dead at the point when they're doing it. But there's no question that one of the reasons they don't really want to bother taking the entire body along is because that takes up space on the boat. And that's money that they could actually pack in more fins. And that's one of the reasons why the trade is so prevalent, that it's a perfect commodity that you can dry, that you can, it's easy to transport, whereas a bulky shark body is something that's more of a liability than an asset.
It would seem, if you look at a shark, it's got this big muscular body, there would be really delicious meat. Is a shark fin particularly tasty?
What's interesting about shark fins is that they're actually tasteless when you take, basically, it's the needles of the fin that are dried and made into noodles. And so you actually don't taste anything at all. To some extent, they're prized for their texture. But more than anything else, it's just a status symbol. It's just the idea that you were willing to pay this much money to serve. Usually it's your guests at a wedding or an important business meal, that it's a sign of respect. And that's the allure of the shark fin, rather than, for example, its gastronomic value.
And is there any way to limit the practices by which sharks are fished or hunted in international waters?
Well, there is, but it's very difficult. And there's been a lot of efforts on that. Part of it is that there are regional fishing bodies around the world that have been having debates. Actually, just in the last week, there were fishery nations, including the U.S. was represented, that have banned the take of one of the most imperiled species of sharks, oceanic whitetip, in the Western and Central Pacific. Back here at home, what we're seeing in the United States is there's been a movement state by state to ban the sale, trade, and possession of shark fins. And in fact, while this is already law in Hawaii, California, Washington, and Oregon, there are folks here in Texas who are talking about introducing this legislation here. And so that's the kind of response you're seeing, which in some ways is easier to achieve than these kind of broad international agreements.
And sharks are found everywhere there is salt water, essentially?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it depends. Sometimes when it gets really, really cold, it's tough. But what's so interesting is they've even figured out how, you know, salmon sharks that can swim off Alaska thrive in a certain temperature, whereas great whites like chilly water, but not quite as chilly as that. So they're incredibly resilient. And again, they can go from the tropics to some of the coldest seas that we have.
Tell us about what makes shark skin unique.
Well, what's cool about the shark skin is that basically it has what's called armored skin teeth or denticles. And this is this incredible, if anyone's ever felt sharks, you know, one thing you can tell about that is it's smooth on one side when if you pet it in one direction, and then it's rough in the other, and it's like sandpaper. And what that is it really gives them this asset as they move through the water. This hard enamel-like covering actually channels water so that they can swim faster. And so it's just an incredible thing. And in fact, it's as tough as steel. It's an incredible defense that they can have against, you know, anyone who might think that they want to take a bite of a shark.
And then they have those magnificent teeth, which are the stuff of nightmares for some people. Yeah. And there are different, I guess, patterns by which those teeth develop. But tell us a little bit about the shark teeth.
Well, so exactly. And it's all pretty terrifying. It's hard to sugarcoat it. But one thing is that they have rows of teeth. And so one thing that's incredible is that, so, you know, whereas if we break a tooth and we obviously have to go to the dentist, for them, they literally can just replace and replenish their teeth supply, you know, throughout their entire lifetime. And then one thing that's fascinating is the shape of their teeth in certain species actually changes over time, because a juvenile, for example, white shark might, you know, basically have slightly smaller prey than an adult white that's actually going to go after something with, say, a lot of blubber, and so really needs that kind of razor-sharp teeth. And so that's one of the things that's so fascinating, is because sharks have evolved so long ago, and because they live in so many different surroundings, they've adapted with all these really interesting features. And so their teeth reflect that as much as anything else.
How close to the shore do they typically swim?
You know, that's a great question. And there's not an easy answer to that. I mean, the fact is they can come very close to shore. And we obviously people have experienced that firsthand. And, you know, it really depends. They tend to come closer to shore at dawn and dusk, whereas they often are further out at other times of day. And again, it would depend on if you're a juvenile lemon shark, you want the mangroves that are right up to shore. And so you're going to actually use that as protection for yourself. Whereas once you're ocean going, you might go further. And so it really depends. But certainly you're more likely to have, say, sharks in the juvenile stages of their life being closer to shore.
When my kids were little and they were afraid of a chipmunk or a squirrel, I would say, you know, they don't eat little girls. And in fact, sharks are the same way. If they had their choice, a human is like last on the menu.
Absolutely. And in fact, actually, when you say that, it's funny. One of my favorite researchers, someone from the University of Sydney, Christopher Neff, refers to humans as in the way, not on the menu. And that is the best way, I think, to describe. We're honestly just not fatty enough for them. We're not what they need. Now, granted, not many people will take comfort in the fact that they do this thing called bite and spit, which is sometimes they might take a bite out of their prey, whether it's a seal or whether it's inadvertently a human and spit out. But most of the time, they're never actually deliberately targeting humans. And even, you know, there are plenty of times where actually people do get in scrapes with a black tip or something like that, and it actually can be a fairly minor. It's rare that it's kind of this lethal thing.
I'm thinking you and I both grew up in the Jaws era, but I remember around that time kids saying if you had even a tiny cut on your body and you were bleeding in the water that you would attract a school of sharks, also a myth.
Right. Definitely that is, you know, while it's like one should not really deliberately, I mean, there are other reasons you might not want to go in the water if you happen to be bleeding profusely. But but while, you know, it actually is true that they can they have an incredible sense of smell and they can detect the equivalent of a drop of blood in an Olympic-sized swimming pool, that's really, you know, not the primary thing. And frankly, a bloody barracuda is going to be more appealing to them than, you know, again, someone with a little nick on their finger.
So, Julia, we've talked about the ways that they are being irresponsibly fished or overfished in certain areas and under certain circumstances. But there are people in the world who are doing this sustainably. Can you talk about shark callers?
Yeah. So one of the most interesting journeys that I took when I was working on this book was to a very small village in Papua New Guinea, where there's really the last existing faith tradition that's centered on sharks. One of the things that, frankly, to me was surprising when I researched the book is the fact that there were plenty of cultures that used to worship sharks, and they span the gamut, but they included again the Mayans as well as the Hawaiians and others. But the Papua New Guineans, they're still a band of people. They're all men, actually, who have this prestigious position of shark callers. And they go out and amazingly really do still do hand-to-hand combat with an individual shark and an individual man in a canoe on very rare occasions, which are for important celebrations and things like that. And it's incredible. They really feel this connection. They have a very elaborate worldview that centers on the fact that they are the one group of people in the world who can actually call and summon sharks through using coconut rattles, and that they use them to sustain their traditions as well as the villages in certain times.
How long does it take for sharks to respond to these sounds?
That's a very good question. Partially it kind of depends on, you know, the day. It's like fishing. Mm-hmm. But they can come relatively quickly. And again, usually it's what's interesting is that when they're shaking that coconut rattle, that mimics the sound of, say, a school of fish that are in trouble. So that's really what's drawing the sharks more than anything else. And, you know, then basically there is an extended struggle that goes on where they have a very interesting wooden noose contraption so that they essentially are catching the shark and tiring it out so ultimately they can club it and then bring it back in their canoes.
My guest this hour is Juliet Alperin. She is national environmental reporter for The Washington Post. Her new book is called Demon Fish: Travels Through the Hidden World of Sharks.
Bye. Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where you can design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, global studies, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
I'm Chris Boyd. You're listening to an archive edition of Think. My guest this hour is Juliet Alperin. She is national environmental reporter for The Washington Post and author of the book Demon Fish, Travels Through the Hidden World of Sharks. So, Juliet, there are shark callers in Papua New Guinea, and then there are people who commercially are sort of selling tours to buy sharks. And I was going to say this is like the ultimate guy fantasy to best a shark. But in fact, there are women who are doing this, too.
It's true. It's true that it's very, very funny because I went out, for example, there's a guy named Mark the Shark who's really the kind of the premier guy you go out with if you're in Miami and you want to go on one of these operations. And it's hilarious because, well, the first time I went out with him, it was this bachelor party that had come over from England. And they were so excited, partially because they said, we don't have many sharks off England anymore. So we came to Florida. And you know, I thought, okay, clearly this is this macho thing. But the hilarious thing is the second time I went out with him, not only was it a woman's idea who came with her boyfriend and her family, but then we literally ran into Rosie O'Donnell while I was on the boat. And she ended up coming on a jet ski and boarding the boat with her son and checking it out and ultimately later went out with him. So what's fascinating is it does kind of appeal to everyone in an odd way.
So you said there are no sharks off the coast of England anymore. That's sort of alarming when we think about it. We are obviously taking them out of the ocean faster than they can reproduce. I have to say, scarier to me than the idea of being bitten by a shark now is the idea of shark sex. And this is not, we're not going to talk about anything I think that people will find inappropriate, but can you talk a little bit about the reproduction rituals of sharks?
Yeah. So it's right. It's difficult territory, but if we're going to dive into it. So what's funny is, so first of all, you know, it tends to be pretty rough. And I will say, and there's it seems like in almost any context, there's biting involved. So they're really interesting, although there are differences. Like, for example, kind of the hammerheads are the Amazons of the sea. So what's cool about them is they kind of travel in this pack with the alpha females in the center. And it's the males that can actually get to the center of the pack who are the ones who actually get to, you know, reproduce at the end of the day. And what's fascinating is that then you have things like sand tiger sharks who are certainly not known for their fidelity because, so for example, a female will actually have sex with multiple males and produce litters, you know, that reflect that. And one of the most interesting things, of course, is the fact that there are some female sharks that we've now discovered can reproduce on their own, that basically are in a aquariums and have never had exposure to male sharks when they've been sexually mature. And what we're now just discovering is that some of them can actually, you know, essentially have a embryo that gets fertilized and reproduces. So it's all very weird.
So you talked about some female sharks having multiple partners and having a litter. They do give birth to live young. Most sharks do.
Most do, although there's actually what's so interesting is they kind of run the gamut. They also can deposit egg cases at the bottom of the sea. So, but yeah, but they're definitely ones that do live birth.
I want to talk about these step-sibling sharks that literally go, they fight to the death while in gestation, in their mother's body.
Exactly. And that's and particularly, certainly sand tigers do that. I believe there might be some other ones. But yes, so what is incredible is that in these cases, they actually feed on their siblings in utero. And that's basically what sustains them. And then they come out. And as one scientist explained to me, you know, they're experienced killers. They're ready to go from the get-go. So it is really freaky. And there's still research being done on this, but it appears that they target, as you mentioned, the step siblings. They actually target the baby sharks that are coming from a different parent. So there seems to be kind of, again, sibling rivalry to the extreme.
It really is like a Darwinism to the extreme as well. I suppose parents whose kids aren't getting along can take comfort in the story of sharks.
Exactly. At least they don't do that. So you can say that, like, maybe there's hair pulling and biting and pinching involved, but not that bad.
And it takes a long time in most cases. If sharks that do give birth to live young, this is not a quick process.
It's not. And, you know, the worst is the spiny dogfish have one of the longest gestation periods. Those females are pregnant for nearly 2 years, which I think any woman who's had a kid would know that is definitely rough sledding. And so one thing that's interesting is that is why they're vulnerable. That basically, I think when we think of fish, we think, gosh, you know, fish, they reproduce and there are tons of young and things like that. With, again, some of these animals, first of all, it takes them years to get to the point where they actually could have offspring. And then when they do, some sometimes they're having one, two, at most, you know, four, six. There are some exceptions, but basically, because the gestation period is taking so long, they simply can't reproduce at a rate that can sustain the kind of fishing pressure that we have on them right now.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest this hour is Washington Post environmental reporter Juliet Eilprin. Her book is called Demon Fish, Travels Through the Hidden World of Sharks. Let's go first on the line to Juan in Dallas. Hi, Juan.
Hi, long time don't hear your voice.
Well, I'm glad you're back with us.
Okay, I just got a quick question and a comment. I just want to find out if your research or your guest research has anything to do with somebody who is a legend in the Caribbean who in the 1970s, he did not have any schooling or anything. He used to swim with the sharks. He invited me to do this. Several times I got attacked by the sharks and got bitten by them or whatever. But his name is Carita. And he lives in San Juan, Puerto Rico, and he's a leading expert on sharks' behavior. Even though he has never gone to school, he has done that naturally.
Well, and, let's get an answer for you. Thanks, Juan.
I actually haven't run into this particular individual, so I'm not familiar with him. But it's true, one of the things is, while, again, I spent much of my time talking to scientists and seeing what they were doing out in the field, you could get some of the most interesting stories from people who don't have that formal training. For example, there's a Mexican fisherman named Mele, who I spent time with in Baja, California, and he was originally a shark fisherman. That's what he did his whole career. He is now a shark conservationist, and he basically is trying to convince other fishermen who he works with to basically promote ecotourism and get people to come and be attracted to watch, say, whale sharks instead of targeting them and other sharks for their meat and their fins.
So, Juliet, you are gonzo enough that you not only went all over the world to talk to these scientists and to these people who are in the shark industry, but you got underwater up close and highly personal with sharks.
It's true, and a whole range of species. So it depends. I was, for example, did cage diving off South Africa with great whites to see, of course, the shark that is the shark of our nightmares.
Let me jump in for a second, because the cage, I think to myself, you can know intellectually that you're completely safe in this thing, but does it really give you a sense that you're okay?
It does. I will say that I was actually scared on my way out there. Before getting into the water, I was scared. Once I was, it was a very firm cage, and I actually was not freaked out when I was in there. But again, it also was, that was not my first shark dive, and my first time in the water with them, and I think if it had been, I would have been a lot more terrified. And so I would say that when I opt to be in a water for sharks, I would definitely go for one of the non-lethal species, such as, for example, whale sharks, where I had an incredible time swimming with them off the Yucatan. And that's something where, again, even kids can go in the water with them, and they're just incredible animals to see.
Well, you had an incredible time, but it's like a Volkswagen bus coming at you, right?
Yeah, and so that was one of my takeaways is you know, while I don't know if anyone has ever been killed by being run over by a shark, I did not want to be the first person in the historic record, and as a result, I was able to duck. But it was something that I hadn't really calculated or banked on before I got in the water.
I mean, obviously, you'd seen videos and pictures, and you'd studied all up on these before you went out there. What can you learn and tell about these animals, seeing them close up, that you wouldn't have understood fully if you had just done all your research on land?
For me, I think what I was struck by is how beautifully designed they are and how they move through the water, how they are really in their element, and just how formidable a force they are, just a physical force, and how they move. And I hadn't really thought of that before, you know, when you can read as much as you want, but you kind of really do need to see that for yourself to be struck by how suited they are for the ocean and how incredible they are and how they have all these wonderful, you know, features that we're talking about that we're trying to emulate at this point.
Another myth about sharks, or I don't know if it's a myth, but let's talk about shark cartilage, which I think in like the early 2000s, late 90s was this like giant remedy.
Absolutely. And that, and you're right that that is a myth in the sense that people were, for example, using powdered shark cartilage on this idea that it'll help you with arthritis, and you can still buy that. And in fact, recently there have been studies coming out suggesting not only does it not really help you with your joints, but on top of that, because sharks, frankly, accumulate some of the toxins that are emitted into the atmosphere, that they, in fact, have some toxins in, you know, in their cartilage. And therefore, you wouldn't want to be ingesting that anyway. And that, you know, one of the interesting things, I think, is because we're so drawn to their power and what they can do. Again, we kind of endow them with these superhuman powers, often to not only their detriment, but to ours.
I want to talk a little bit about our perception that they have superhuman powers. As you are quick to point out in the book, this was all long before the Peter Benchley novel. But Peter Benchley himself ultimately became really a champion of ocean.
Yeah, it's really interesting because I think what's funny, and if you go back, I did go back and read the book when I was writing this, that what's fascinating is when he was writing this book in the early 70s, you know, we frankly didn't know as much about them that we knew now. But he was able to both, first of all, describe things in a fairly accurate way, but also he just tapped into this primal fear that we had. You know, again, people had been scared of them before, but he was so vivid in both his writing and then ultimately, of course, in the movie that stemmed from it, that it really did terrify people in a way they hadn't. And it did absolutely lead to an uptick in, for example, recreational shark fishing and kind of this idea that people would go out to kill them. And what's fascinating is he really, shortly thereafter, he made it very clear in interviews that he didn't endorse the killing of sharks and then spent many, many years crusading for oceans. And in fact, his widow, Wendy Benchley, who's a friend of mine and a personal hero, she to this day works on ocean issues because I think that that basically they did feel some level of responsibility and wanted to make it clear that we shouldn't buy into all the myths that we have about sharks.
My research on your work did not take me so far as to read the book myself, but you actually say it's more cerebral than the movie might lead us to believe.
It's true. There's some really interesting stuff about class warfare and tensions. It's interesting because Peter Benchley did go to Nantucket as a child and actually even met his wife there. And so I think he was aware of kind of the difference between the people who live there year round and the people who come for the summer. And that's one of the interesting things. So, yeah, I found it actually much more compelling. And, of course, the funny thing is that while, again, we were all scared when we saw it, of course, in terms of its special effects, it pales in comparison to recent movies. So that's why I actually think the book at this point is more powerful than the movie.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Rockwall. We've got George on the line. Hey, George.
Hello. I've enjoyed listening to your programs for many years.
Thank you.
I just wanted to comment on a couple of things that the author had mentioned. I'm an avid scuba diver. I've been scuba diving for almost 40 years. I have a master's in marine biology, and I've interacted with sharks all over the world, from the Blue Corner in Palau, Fiji, the Philippines, like I said, just all over the world. And I've always found them to be very, very docile, almost intimidated more by us than we are of them.
George is exactly right. I mean, the fact of the matter is often, you know, they either ignore humans, particularly I think when it's not an accident that, for example, scuba divers don't have nearly the rates of incidents involving sharks as, say, surfers, because with scuba divers, they can actually see you. And, you know, what's so interesting that George mentioned, for example, Palau and Fiji. Palau was the first country in the world to create a shark sanctuary a few years ago to say there will be no shark fishing in our waters because we want people to dive and spend time in the water with sharks. And in fact, Fiji is on the verge of adopting projections as well. So it gives you a sense that these are some of the places where people are interacting the most closely with sharks, and yet they're the places that are most invested in their conservation.
There are these questions about sort of chumming the waters in order to bring a bunch of sharks in, and I guess you can look at this both ways.
Yeah, and I actually think that's one of the areas where I think there needs to be more research. There's been some, but I think not enough to give us a sense. I mean, we certainly have seen some studies that have suggested, for example, in terms of rays in the Caymans, rays which are related there to sharks, that basically they, for example, have adjusted their patterns and gone from being nocturnal to diurnal because they're being fed during the day. I think that, you know, when there were strikes off the Red Sea a year ago, there were questions about whether the feeding might have contributed to human-shark interaction. So I think we need more analysis because while ecotourism has been, frankly, a driver for shark conservation, observation, we don't want to be doing things that really alter both the way sharks behave and, of course, pose an additional threat to humans.
Sort of a related email here from David, who says, when we see National Geographic shows about predator species like hawks and wolves, we often don't get to see these animals in their most aggressive state. With sharks, the first thing most folks do is throw fish meat into the water, bringing out that predatory nature. I'd be curious to know your thoughts about the inherent prejudice people have about sharks, which seems worse than other animals, and not surprising since we don't dangle meat in front of other predator species.
That's an excellent point by your listener. You know, one thing I would say is, I mean, first of all, that all of that makes sense, and that, you know, one thing that I really try to think about is, why is it that we're more terrified of sharks than even, you know, I mean, first of all, polar bears, you know, there were a couple lethal incidents with polar bears last year, but people still think they're warm and cuddly and, you know, aren't terrified by them in the same way. And I think part of it, what I came away with, for better or worse, is this idea that they can come out of the darkness and that we don't necessarily see them when we strike. Maybe it's, you know, maybe we're fooling ourselves, but we have this idea that maybe you'd at least see a grizzly bear or a mountain lion coming. And with a shark, because it's often something that you wouldn't see them first, mm-hmm. I think for some reason that terrifies us in a way that even other predators don't. But I think there's no question that exactly what your listener is saying, that when we're kind of egging on their most aggressive state, that certainly doesn't help things.
What sort of patterns do they swim in when they are ready to attack?
That's a good question. And it does depend on the species. But there's no question that, you know, when you think in your mind of kind of that lazy figure eight that they're doing in the water, that there's no question that, for example, again, with great whites, where there's a lot of attention, that they do stalk their prey, that essentially they are going back and forth and they are lying in wait for when they will pounce. Now, again, it can be different with different species. And, you know, for example, with whale sharks that are actually feed on plankton, they're filter feeders. So with them, what they're doing is literally ingesting thousands of gallons of water every day and, you know, getting fed off of that. So that's a totally different form of feeding.
My guest this hour is Juliet Alperin. She's national environmental reporter for The Washington Post and author of Demon Fish, Travels Through the Hidden World of Sharks.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where you can design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, global studies, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
I'm Chris Boyd. You're listening to an archive edition of Think. My guest this hour is Juliet Alperin. She is national environmental reporter for The Washington Post and author of the book Demon Fish, Travels Through the Hidden World of Sharks. Juliet, I did not know until very recently that sharks could have bioluminescence.
Yes. I have to say, in the same way you don't want to choose among your children, I don't really want to say that, you know, one species is better, but I love the cookie cutter shark, mm-hmm. which it does glow and has this really incredible bioluminescence camouflage, where because they have bioluminescent scales over most of their body but then have kind of a dark pigmentation right around kind of their collar, as a result they can fool bigger fish, including tuna or even marine mammals like porpoises, into thinking they're a school of fish, and then they actually can attack and bite cookie-shaped chunks out of them. So I feel like that's pretty cool.
Yeah, the name sounds so unthreatening, but I suppose if you're in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Although, if it's any, again, consolation, until actually recently, there had never been a case of a cookie-cutter human shark attack, but there has been one back in 2009 in Hawaii. But so on the panoply of risks, they're so far down, I think you can still think they're adorable.
So I want to talk about these risks again, because, okay, so we kill 73 million sharks a year. We humans, I should say. And they, on average, kill less than 10.
Yeah. Historically, it's generally, recently it's averaged 5. Last year was actually a shocking year, and it was 12.
So worldwide.
Worldwide. None in the United States last year, in fact. So really, you know, it's just incredible when, you know, when there was all this publicity recently just about the lottery and people were talking about, you know, being struck by lightning again. You know, lightning beats shark strikes. Firework accidents beat shark strikes. There are plenty of snakes are, you know, many, many more times more likely to kill you. So, they're just not something in the grand scheme of things one needs to worry about.
I actually put that human shark scorecard on my Facebook page, and I had a friend write back that humans do not understand probability or statistics, and that is why they buy lottery tickets and fear sharks.
There you go.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Stevie now in Denton. Hi, Stevie.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
I just started listening to the program recently, and just wanted to say that I've been so interested in all the topics that you guys have discussed. But
great.
I just had a question for you or for your guest right now, which is, what would you tell someone who is aspiring to be a marine biologist? I just have been so interested in this type of thing, and I'm actually going to start going to school for it soon, and I was wondering if she could give me any advice for that specific section of the science world.
Oh, mainly I would say you've picked a great choice. I have to say that you might tell from reading my book that, you know, if I could have been something else, I kind of think now that being a marine biologist would be a great job. So I think it's fascinating. And one of the great things, and I think we're really lucky given the coastline that we have in the United States, is that there's so many places you can pursue that it's not like you have to go to one institution, that, you know, there's incredible research being done in this area. There's incredible research all up and down the West Coast as well as the East and, you know, other places in the Gulf. And so I think one of the things is that there really are a lot of opportunities there. And also that, you know, that basically one thing I think is incredible is you can do academic research which has applicability to the real world. I often joke, you know, one of my college roommates who I love, she's a French historian who studies piracy from several hundred years ago. It's a fascinating topic, but it's not the kind of thing that has the same actual everyday implications for our lives, whether you're talking about, you know, biomedical breakthroughs or, again, just understanding fishing practices, how we're going to sustain this population by eating seafood. There's just so many things you can explore. So I think it's a fantastic and wide open field.
The other thing about marine biologists is that they seem to, in my experience, have pretty peripatetic careers. Now I'm mixing up metaphors, but okay. they don't often stay only in one part of the world. They go all over.
They do. And I also have to say, and I would, you know, of course, I'm a little biased. I'd say journalists are these ways too, but they're fun people to hang out with. That's the other thing that, you know, one of the reasons I often write about oceans in my day job is just because, you know, I can talk to scientists of all stripes, but if you give me a choice of who I want to be around for an extended period of time, I pick a marine biologist any day.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next on the phones to Jody in Dallas. Hey, Jody.
Hey, Chris. Thanks for your show.
Oh, sure.
My son was reading a book about sharks just yesterday evening, so this show is very timely. And he had mentioned that I think it was the bull shark has an incredible immune system, and particularly against fighting cancers. And I was wondering if your guest could expound on that.
So that's interesting. So now one thing I should say, bull sharks are generally known for having the highest testosterone level of any animal. So that's generally their claim to fame. But your caller makes a really interesting point, which is that, so one thing is that sharks rarely do get cancer. And so this is, again, kind of rise to some myths about this idea that, again, you know, we should eat or powder them up or do different things to avoid cancer. And while that kind of line of research has been debunked at this point, there actually is some really interesting research being done concerning cancer and sharks. This is being done at Moat Marine Lab in Sarasota, Florida. I was recently meeting with a scientist there who's working on it, and they're looking at some incredible things, both in terms of looking at whether we can figure out there is basically a substance that sharks have that seems to target cancerous cells, and is there a way that we can kind of come up with some synthetic version of that? Or also, when she mentions immunity, in fact, this scientist just got a grant from the Defense Department to to kind of look for a better antibiotic ointment to put on our wounded men and women who are serving abroad. And so that's another innovation that we might get for sharks, and it's kind of one of the other reasons why it might be worth keeping them around.
Is there a sort of turf territorialism among marine biologists who work mostly in the lab and they're in marinas as opposed to those who are out in the deep water studying animals in their natural environment?
Yeah, there is. And actually, that is one of the things. I think they are different cultures. Like, for example, the biochemist who's trying to do something and with sharks in the lab and also kind of sees them more in a traditional research way, that's a different culture from the people who are, for example, Mark Erdman, who I spent time with, who's a scientist at Conservation International, who's discovering new species when he goes diving in the waters in Indonesian Papua. So that's one of the ways that there's a lot of diversity.
What happens in regions where there used to be plentiful sharks and now there are not enough?
What we've seen is a disruption in the food chain, that basically what's happened is that you have an explosion of mid-level predators who often then overconsume a species that are lower down in the food chain. This has been a problem. So, for example, off the East Coast where I'm from, where we've really decimated a lot of the large sharks, you've had mid-level predators take off, and this has had implications for everything from oysters to scallops, where they're being wiped out because, frankly, you just don't have those top-level predators to keep things in check.
And it's interesting because the mid-level predators essentially compete with us humans for all the delicious things we want to eat.
Exactly. And so, you know, it's not that that's a thing. And while, in fact, it's interesting, there's been a whole debate, for example, in the Chesapeake Bay, they're talking about you should eat cow nose rays because, you know, that will help keep things in check. There's some real scientists who question whether we actually want to just go do that or whether we could just do a better job of protecting sharks in the first place. But yeah, what's happening is that we don't generally benefit by the animals that are expanding once sharks are gone, that in fact we'd be better off if we essentially allowed them to be there so that the things that we eat lower down on the food chain are still around.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Remember, you can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Tom on the line in Plano. Hello, Tom.
Hi. I enjoy your show every day.
Thank you.
I understand from a recent episode of River Monsters that the bull sharks can get into fresh water and live there. And actually, the first 5 years of a bull shark's life is spent in fresh water. Could your guest comment on that, please?
That is absolutely... Thanks. That's absolutely true. And that is one of the reasons I have to say, while again, sometimes there are some people who have given me flack for it. I'm still a little scared of bull sharks, and I'm willing to admit it. And part of it is that they can get into fresh water. And in fact, there's, you know, one of the debates, some of your listeners might be aware of the spate of attacks in 1916 off the Jersey Shore, which is one of the things that really terrified people. There was a shark strike in a river, in the Mattawan River, and there's some speculation they've never figured out what species of shark it is, but it could have easily been a bull shark for that reason.
I don't think it was in the book. It may have been in some other materials, but I saw a picture of you somewhere standing like ankle deep in water holding a shark.
That was a lemon shark in the mangroves of Bimini. And one of the reasons I could hold that shark is because another cool fun fact is that you can hypnotize sharks by flipping them over upside down. And so that shark was
like chickens? Can't you do that with chickens too?
Maybe you can. And so that was kind of the closest, literally, I think that would be the closest I've ever gotten to a shark. But again, it was both a juvenile and it was hypnotized, so it was okay.
Did you hypnotize it?
I actually did not. I took over from a real scientist who did hypnotize it. So it was easy. It was very light lifting for me.
So you say light lifting. How dense do they feel? I mean, are they pretty heavy based on their size?
That's an interesting question. They are pretty dense. And again, one thing, and I've also done tagging of sharks, which has involved lassoing them, and that's a moment that, again, you're up close with sharks, where, I mean, mainly I'm struck by their skin. That's the thing that really resonates with me and that I think about, just kind of that very cool sandpapery element of them. But they are, I mean, what you really do feel is that they're muscle. And, mm-hmm. and that's really one of their most defining elements, that they have power in them, even when they're tiny and even when they're, you know, catatonic.
And the Speedo Corporation would love to be able to make like a truly shark skin synthetic.
Yes. And so there's been modeling on that, but there haven't been quite the, you know, same breakthroughs that you would think. I mean, I think it's pretty hard, and also it is a little hard to imagine what we'd look like if we went to the beach and we were wearing something that had kind of an enamel surface to it. But there's no question that you can go faster, and where that's really being applied is in terms of ships, where there's certainly been scientists, including a German scientist, who has proven that you can really cut down on biofouling and really, for commercial purposes, have ships move faster if they basically imitate sharks.
Biofouling, that's the things that get stuck on the ship, barnacles and
exactly,
things like that.
Barnacles and things, and that slows it down because that introduces drag.
Hmm. How important is eyesight to a shark?
You know, eyesight matters, but it's definitely not their most important sense. They have decent eyesight. It's not that they don't. But there's so many other things that are important to them, including their incredible sense of smell, which freaks us out, as well as their electroreception, this idea that they can sense weak vibrations in the water, whether that's a struggling fish underneath the sand or, you know, other elements. You know, even sometimes that's why they're attracted to maybe dogs that are paddling. So those are kind of the killer instincts that really help sharks excel.
Are there certain things that attract sharks to where people might be?
Well, there has been, again, a loose correlation between, for example, people swimming in the water with dogs. And one of the, again, there's speculation on this. It's hard to know where the science is, but there's an idea that whether it's the erratic paddling of the dog or simply the heartbeat of the dog that might provide an added draw to the sharks, that's kind of one of the things. You don't have to worry about, you know, for example, wearing yellow. There was this fear that yum, yum, yellow, you have yellow fins. That's going to bring the sharks to it. There's really no evidence to support something like that.
And do they like surfboards?
You know, like is an interesting term, but I will say that there certainly seems to be circumstantial evidence that particularly for some of the ones we're most scared of, like white sharks, that from below a surfboard could look like a seal to them. And so there have been, you know, it is not accidental, one would imagine, that as many surfers have been involved in shark strikes. So you know, you're better off if you're, again, a scuba diver just in the water where you have a chance of seeing them.
So many kinds of sharks seem to have like those large prominent snouts, if that's the right term, and I'm sure it's not. Is there a reason for that? Does that reinforce their jaws?
Well, you know, that is a good question, and I don't exactly know the answer to that, although one of the cool things, which again was a recent scientific breakthrough, is that sharks smell in stereo is the way that a scientist described it to me, which is that they have such an incredible sense that basically a scent will hit one nostril, and then a fraction of a second it'll hit another, and as a result they are able to track scent better. And in fact, we're kind of looking to see whether we can create an algorithm that would allow an odor, an odor trained robot to identify chemical spills or oil spills. So it could be, although I'm not sure, that the shape of exactly the, frankly, the shark's snout is something that kind of maximizes that process.
And they have to keep moving all the time.
Most do. There are some, and for example, when people are swimming and they see kind of nurse sharks or wobegons hanging out at the bottom or leopard sharks that you might see in an aquarium. Those can actually manage to kind of stay in one position and have the water wash over them as long as there's enough of a current. But many sharks really do this thing, which is called ram ventilation, which is they're constantly moving even when they're in a sleep-like state, so that essentially the water passes over their gills and provides them with the oxygen they need to survive.
The last thing I want to ask you, Juliet, is how long it took you after you finished the book to stop telling people all these awesome facts, like at every party you went. I mean, were you calling up your friends and saying, guess what I just found out?
I did that some. I tried to keep it in check. And what I feel like I have learned having done this is that really, if you put me with a group of 11-year-old boys, I just can't stop because they want to know everything there is about sharks. So when it's an 11-year-old boy, I let it rip. With other people, I try to at least, you know, contain my shark trivia to a reasonable level so as not to be boring.
Well, it's fascinating stuff to us. So thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Chris.
Juliet Opryn's new book is called Demon Fish, Travels Through the Hidden World of Sharks. Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phone. Christine McConnell does the podcast, and our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. You can download that free daily podcast and find out about upcoming programs at kera.org/think. If you've got questions, comments, or suggestions, send those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.